me begin by asking all of us a question this afternoon. Is there any doubt that we are living in the end time or at the end of the age? Now, I'm speaking to a captive audience, and I think everyone here would say, no, there's no doubt. But, you know, I've heard since I first started attending church that we're living in the last days. And that was over 50 years ago. Have things changed? You know, if you look back to what happened to our previous organization back in the mid-1990s, a lot of people fell to the argument that, well, this is really not the truth, as we had learned what the truth was. And there wasn't the same discipline or the same intensity or the same focus about where we were in prophecy. But I think most of us here today would agree that we are living at the end of the age, the time that the Bible refers to as the end of the age. Certainly we can see all the problems that are around us. They're not going to go away. And the Bible fortunately tells us that while there is a lot of grief ahead, that a lot of positives will occur because Christ will return and His government will be established. But if I ask that same question to another group or different groups, what kind of a response would I get? Now, you're a captive audience, so I know how you feel and think, or at least I think I know how all of you feel and think. But if we went to another group, and this could be a Christian professing group, and we asked the same question, we might get responses such as, well, we've had other times in our history when things looked pretty bad, and we came through it all right. And they may refer to World War I or World War II when things looked pretty grim, or maybe during the Middle Ages, going all the way back almost 1,000 years ago. It must have looked really grim for those individuals, but we came through that. And they may say, well, we've had economic problems in the past. That's nothing new. Think about the Great Depression. Think about what happened back in the 70s when we sat in lines for an hour and a half waiting to get gasoline, or when inflation was 20% and higher. So we've had economic problems. We've had famines. We've had wars. We've had pestilence. We've had catastrophes. But we've always come through that, and we've been stronger. We've been made stronger for that. So this group might admit that things don't look good right now, but they're pretty confident that things are going to get better. We've done it before. We've been there before. And so the end of the age to them, they may think it's going to come at some point, but they don't really think about it as being something now. In fact, they may say that, yes, we've got serious problems and we have concerns, but we'll get through it. We'll figure out how to find our way through it, and things will keep going. Now, I've actually had that discussion with someone not too long ago, not in God's church, but someone who was a professing Christian. And it's always interesting what kind of conversations you can fall into when you get into a subject like this. But a different group that I might ask that same question to might have a totally different reaction. You know, this group would look at the world today with the view that, well, man is always evolving, and this world will evolve too. You know, after all, man's been on the earth for millions of years, and things have kept going, and things will keep going in the future. In fact, the idea of God coming back to the earth, well, that's just a religious idea that's been around a long time. In fact, half the world's population wouldn't even really understand about or even believe in the return of Christ. They don't even know that much about Jesus Christ or anything about God or the plan of God. They have their own religion and their own gods. But this group, this last group I'm referring to, you know, life would just simply keep going. Things would adapt, and whatever changes the world's faced with, we would adapt. And so I would look at this group and look at them and say, for the most part, they would just simply be in bliss is ignorance, or ignorance is bliss, I guess is a better way of saying it. Just, you know, we don't really care. It's, you know, life goes on. You know, most people aren't aware of world events as it relates to prophecy or even the context of prophecy, or certainly not in the context of God's plan. I've read a lot of articles over the years, and certainly even up until just the past few weeks. I've tried to read as many articles that's talking about things that are going on in the world, and certainly over the last 6 months there has been a lot of talk about the state of the world's finances, and that we've never had a time in the history of man where the world has created so much debt. In fact, the debt numbers are so staggering it's not even worth repeating them because they don't make any sense to anybody. We can't even relate. But yet they're there. And the only reason that things haven't blown up is because people haven't lost faith. But the moment that someone could be a country, it could be people, come to the realization that they may not be repaid on any debt or loan that they've made, then somebody unplugs the bathtub. And when you unplug the water in the bathtub, what happens? Everything goes down the drain. And that's the analysis that I've read about. And so I've read numerous articles about the state of the world, and many writers are predicting really difficult times ahead. You know, Mr. Franks alluded to that in his the program this afternoon. Now, I did not see that prior to putting this sermon together. So we're going to touch on a few things that are very similar. But even though writers and editorialists identify that we have great problems, you know, almost every person, to a man or to a woman, believe that we'll just simply come through it, that things will correct themselves, things will get better. And no matter what happens, we're going to figure out how to make a better world. But their idea of a better world is, and always will be, that it will be a human government who steps up and produces the change, creates the correction. And their view is that the future will always be something that man will create and control. But God tells us differently, doesn't he? You know, God tells us that a time is coming when the path of the world, the path that the world is on, there is a time coming that is going to lead to total destruction. If, and that is a big if he did not intervene and save mankind for himself. Let's turn to Mark chapter 13. Because the world is on a path of destruction. And how far are we down that path? And how do we know how far down that path we are? But in Mark chapter 13, let's begin in verse 19. Mark 13 beginning in verse 19. For in those days there will be tribulation, such has not been seen since the beginning of creation, which God created until this time, nor ever shall be. Verse 20, and unless the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh would be saved. I wonder how many people really believe that. You know, can man get to the point where if God did not intervene, man would destroy himself? Most people, the vast majority of people, believe that mankind will never get to that point. That there will always be someone that will come to the rescue, not a spiritual being, but some man or some government, or that the collective senses of countries will keep or prevent this from ever happening. But Christ said very clearly that a time is coming that unless he did not intervene and shorten those days, that mankind would in fact destroy himself, not only himself, but all living flesh. But he says, for the elect's sake, whom he has chosen, he will shorten those days. Now in verse 33 of Mark 13, he goes on to say, and this is the message for all of us today, we're going to go back and look at some other detail in a moment. But in verse 33, if we drop down to that passage, notice what he says. He says, take heed, watch, and pray, for you do not know when the time is. You know, that's a great admonition for all of us in the church today. And turn over one book to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. Luke expands this comment a little bit beyond what Mark recorded for us. But in Luke chapter 21 and in verse 36, similar comment, but a little bit more is conveyed through Luke's writing here. Luke chapter 21 and verse 36. Watch therefore and pray always. You know, Christ said that, or Mark said that through what he recorded in Mark 13:33. But Luke goes on to say, watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Now, the right translation here is not that we can be somehow worthy, but the Greek really means pray that you may have the strength and that you're able to stand and prevail. Pray that we will have the strength to be able to escape the things that will come upon the world. So we're told by Christ that we're to be alert, that we're to be awake. That's what that Greek word means that's translated watch. Be alert. Be awake. Be aware of what's happening. Be vigilant. That's the English translation of that word. And so Christ tells us, be awake. Be vigilant. Be aware of what's happening around us so that we're not caught off guard by the things that will happen in the near future. And he adds, pray that we would have the strength and the endurance to escape. And so this afternoon, I'd like to ask all of us, how do we apply this admonition that Christ gave us here in this prophetic section of Scripture? How are we going to apply this admonition that Christ said to watch and to pray? What do we need to be doing? And what should we be watching for? What should we really be watching for? Now, if we think back through man's history, God has intervened in man's history two times, going back to since the time that man was created. We're all familiar with the story of Noah's flood, and we know that God intervened in man's affairs then. It's recorded in Genesis 6. The other time that God intervened in man's affairs is recorded a couple chapters later, and it's regarding the Tower of Babel. God confused the languages, and he intervened in the direction that man was going to go. The Bible tells us that during Noah's time, that man's thoughts were to do evil continuously. And God knew that if he didn't intervene, that man would eventually destroy himself. Long before his purposed plan in terms of years that he was going to give mankind. And then we come to the Tower of Babel, and God saw that here was a period of time, shortly after the flood actually, everyone was congregated pretty much in the same area of the world, but he saw that there was a complete rejection of him in the attitudes of the people at that time. And so the fullness of their pride and their envy and their disdain for God was reflected when they decided they were going to build this enormous monument. It says they were going to build a tower all the way into the heavens. And they were going to build it for themselves. And to God, that was an affront. That was a manifestation of their pride and vanity. And their completely desire to cast off God from having anything to do with them. And so God said that unless he went down and confounded them through their language and caused them to divide, that there would be nothing left that was impossible for them. And so we have that account. And all this happened in the first, really in the first 2,000 years of man's history. The Bible tells us that God will once again intervene in man's history. A third time he will intervene. But the next time is going to be a time of great sorrow, great distress, great horror that will come upon the world. It'll be a time that the Bible refers to as the Great Tribulation. And it will end with the return of Christ and the establishment of God's government upon the earth. You know, the Bible doesn't give us the date for when this is going to occur. You know, man has looked for generations and years, and there has been speculation galore on, I know the date that Christ is coming back. And people have hung their entire reputation on that, sold everything, only to be refuted through time that they didn't know that date after all. And the Bible doesn't give us a date. And yet people continually try to figure out when is that time. You know, we're just, I guess, dumb sheep in that respect. We want to know. And so we go through all kinds of extensions to figure out, well, what is that date? When is he going to return? But the Bible doesn't give us a date, but it does forecast for us what the conditions will be like, or what the conditions will be, what will be in existence during the time or right before the time that Christ returns. There will be indicators that refer to or tell us or identify what is going to be the close of this present age. In fact, I think it was the Apostle Paul that referred to it as this present evil age. And so there's going to be indicators. So let's consider a few of the areas that we should be watching and understand how they're going to fulfill the prophecy that is given throughout the Bible, but primarily prophecies that were recorded for us in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13, and certainly the book of Revelation. We have a clue already when we read Mark chapter 13. When we read that, for in those days there will be great tribulation, and unless Christ intervened and shortened them, no flesh would be saved alive. So the first thing that all of us should be aware of and that we should be watching, and we've been doing this now for a number of years, especially for those of us who have logged many years in the church. But Jesus told his disciples that humanity would come to a point in time, they would reach a point where all human life could actually be wiped out. When did that occur? 1945, the atom bomb. Two bombs were dropped on Japan in 1945. And up until that point in time, there was no weapon capable of destroying completely life on the earth. That was 70 years ago. Two bombs were created or built, and they were dropped. Only two have ever been used in war, both in 1945. Do any of us feel that those were the only two times that bomb will ever be used? No. Because every weapon that man has ever created has been used in war. So in the middle 1940s, when the atom bomb was invented, that became the first time that man could actually destroy all life from the face of the earth. And since 1945, the technology has only grown better and more prolific. You know, it was a struggle for the U.S. to put those two bombs together. And now there are thousands of those bombs scattered throughout the world. Enough that at some point in time, a number of years ago, and I haven't seen this statistic upgraded, but there was a point in time a few years ago when there was enough nuclear weapons estimated to be in the world that could destroy life 50 times over. How many times does it take? The other 49 don't matter. Damage is already done with the first time. But there were that many nuclear weapons in the world that life could be destroyed 50 times over. You know, when I was growing up, there was a lot of urgency around the fear of a nuclear war. How many of you remember drills in school where you had to jump under the desk, or you had to go to the closet, or you had to go to the bathroom, or the restroom, I should say, or you had to run outside and go in the gym? Anybody but me do that? Oh, yeah, a number of hands. I remember clearly, we would have drills in elementary school. When the bell rang out, you know, the principal yelled down the hallway, and we made our way to wherever that safety zone was dedicated that we should go. Now, that was, date myself here, that was 40 years ago. We don't do that any longer. There was a period of time when many individuals were building bunkers and storing food, and they were going to survive in those bunkers for weeks or months or even years. The only problem was they didn't build an air passage that could eliminate the fallout, the radioactive fallout. You know, people, I think, today understand intellectually that these weapons exist. But how many people in the world understand emotionally that these weapons exist? Where is the fear factor? I think we've all felt that if a terrorist organization gets a hold of one of these, they will use it. And that no doubt will happen. But I think most people have lost the emotional attachment to, we live in a nuclear age. They don't think about it. Most people reason that, well, that, you know, other than a terrorist group getting a small nuke, you know, man's not going to be foolish enough to set those things off. But yet God clearly said that if he didn't shorten the time, man would destroy himself. Albert Einstein made the following comment. I don't know all of the exact weapons that World War III will be fought with. But I do know that World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. Now, there is a lot of insight into that comment if you think about it. He very clearly is telling us that, in his mind, life is going to go on, but it's going to be primitive. It's going to be very primitive. You see, we can't, even our scientists can't quite get to the point where, yep, life's going to be completely snuffed out. Even Einstein felt that it could get bad, but somehow, some way, life would go on. Primitively, but life would go on. And yet Christ was very clear that if without spiritual intervention, it would not go on. Second thing that we should be watching for, and this is something that's going on right now, is that we should be watching Europe with a very close eye. You know, the Bible tells us that a final revival of the Roman Empire is going to occur, that final government structure is going to come upon the earth, and that it will arise in such a way that it controls vast parts of the world's population. It's described in Daniel and Revelation as a beast. And this final beast power is going to be a powerful union between government and religion. And it's going to have a union with great dominion and great influence. And this beast, that's referred to in Revelation 17, is going to be especially ruthless with the descendants of Jacob. It is going to be ruthless with any of God's people who are not protected. Turn with me over to Revelation chapter 17. In Revelation 17. And let's begin in verse 7. Revelation 17 and beginning in verse 7. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. And then dropping down to verse 12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet. Now notice, these are ten kings who have not received a kingdom. You know, I'm not sure that we totally understand how this is going to occur, but what it seems to indicate here is that there are going to be 10 rulers, 10 kings, who may at some point in time in the future be appointed, as a king over a nation or a group of nations. Because there are 10 kings who've received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So their authority, their quality of rulership, their license in that sense, seems to be controlled by this beast or beast power, or no doubt the individual that's referred to also as the beast. Then verse 13 goes on to say, these are all of one mind. They think the same way. They're on the same page with each other. There is a unity with them. And they give their power and authority to the beast. So here's going to be a unification, a strong unification of mind and purpose. Verse 14, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. So here we see clearly that this is the government, the end time government, that's going to be in power, at least in Europe, and over what I would speculate to be vast areas of the earth. Maybe not over China or Russia, because they go to war with those nations later. But here, they're clearly going to be over all of Europe, and no doubt they will have control over the modern descendants of Jacob as well. But where is this 10 group or 10 king group going to come from? Will it be from nations out of the current European Union? I don't know. Is the current makeup of the European Union simply going to eventually devolve? And then out of its ashes, will come this new beast? I don't know. But there's other prophecies in the Bible. I'm not going to turn to them. And I think they're back in Revelation 13. This power is going to control the economics of the world in a very significant way. In fact, you're going to have to be marked with some type of a mark or an apparatus, or you're going to have some, you know, some grant from this government structure in order to conduct commerce, in order to eat. And I can see that happening given the state of the financial condition of the world. Because if things fall apart and collapse, someone is going to have to pick up the pieces, and that, in fact, may be how this group is put together, is that the Western economies simply collapse. And so out of the need for survival and power and authority, this beast power may come on the scene. So we don't know whether it's nations out of the current European Union or if it's going to be something altogether different. But I will tell you, in the 50 years of being in the church, A lot of change has occurred. And going way back to who we thought was the beast power, to who we now realize wasn't the beast power, I think we have a much clearer and a better understanding of what that power is ultimately going to look like, but it's still very foggy. But we're told to watch. And it's clear that Germany right now is the strong fist of Europe. All you have to do is read what conditions were put up on Greece last week. And actually, I read yesterday that they finally got $29 billion in funding yesterday. But just go back and read the conditions that Germany put upon them. It wasn't France. It wasn't the Netherlands. It wasn't Spain. It wasn't Italy. It was Germany. And Germany said, if you are going to get these funds, this is what we are going to require of you. And so the little lesson here is that if you, as a nation, join the European Union, you are not likely to get out. You are there for good. So we'll see. But certainly Germany is clearly the strong fist of Europe right now. She is strong economically, and I just read recently that she leads the world currently in trade surpluses. So that's, again, a very positive move for Germany. So watch. We'll watch Europe. The third area that the Bible tells us, and I'm not covering all of them today. I just want to give you the highlight of four of them. But another area that we're told to watch, and that is what happens in the Middle East. Now, the Middle East, and especially the area of Jerusalem and the immediate surrounding areas of Jerusalem, have and will have a central focus for prophecy. We certainly know that God or Christ is going to return to Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives specifically, which is just outside of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is going to be the focal point at the very end for that final battle that's identified in Revelation, where the eastern armies come together. But the Middle East is a focal point for prophecy. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. In Luke chapter 21, and beginning in verse 20, Luke 21, beginning in verse 20, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter into her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written must be fulfilled. Now there was a type of this fulfillment back in 70 AD. But that was a very, very minor type of what's described here. This greater fulfillment. And that's what Christ is referring to here, is all things. That's the final fulfillment of this prophecy. And there will come a time when the power, the Eastern power, or the European power, the beast power, will set up, no doubt, his headquarters in this area of the world. Now let's turn back to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11, another prophecy, and this is referring to that very end time. But in Daniel chapter 11, we'll read two verses here, beginning in verse 40. Daniel 11, beginning in verse 40. And at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. And other translations say that this king of the south will push at him. And that's probably a better translation. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Verse 41. And he will enter into the glorious land, and many countries will be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And we can see today that the nation that's there now, the nation that's called Israel, although they are the descendants of Judah, that world opinion has been against them for a long time. In fact, that whole area of the Middle East has been really in turmoil all of modern history since the nation of Israel was formed, and even prior to that. It's been a hotbed for going all the way back to the time of Christ. But we can certainly see now as we begin to watch that area and some of the things that are taking place, I would never have thought in my lifetime that the United States, which has always, as far as I can remember, have been a very close ally of Israel, begin to separate and begin to walk away. And that may change. I mean, with a different president and a different administration, it's possible that could be healed, that rift could be changed. But certainly in the last 6 years, there has been a constant pressure and a pulling away, and a pulling away of support for Israel. In fact, I'll just refer you to this recent agreement that the United States and other nations have made with Iran, and this has yet to be ratified by the U.S. Congress, but one of the conditions that was made very clear to Israel, and by the way, this has been approved at the United Nations level, which now you can understand why some of the fallout from this may be a little bit difficult in the future. But one of the things that has been made very clear to Israel, and I don't know that this has been widely reported, is if Israel takes the initiative to attack or to bomb Iran to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, the United States has told Israel they will enter on the side of Iran. So that has not been reported. But that's, again, as I said, there's been a parting of the way, and that could change. But as we watch the Middle East, I believe we're going to see more and more isolation for that nation of Judah. The fourth thing that we are to watch, and that is that we are to watch for the moral decline and the impending tribulation that will come upon Jacob's descendants. That we're watch for the moral decline and impending tribulation that will come upon Jacob's descendants. In Leviticus 26, this is a prophetic chapter that I think most of us are familiar with. It's a chapter we often refer to as the blessings and cursings. I think the other chapter is Deuteronomy 28. But in Leviticus 26, God pronounced a section of blessings and a section of curses. And if you haven't read these verses lately, I would recommend you go back and read through this, because some of the penalties or curses that God said would occur, they're almost clearly happening, almost word for word, lifting it right out of Scripture. Certainly the passage that talks about him taking away the power of Israel, that's happening. But I would like to at least quote a couple of these verses here in Leviticus 26, beginning in verse 14. Because this is what God told ancient Israel, and this prophecy, by the way, is for all of the descendants of Israel throughout time. And this is going to really culminate here at the end of the age. But in verse 14 of Leviticus 26, God tells them, he says, "If you do not obey me," and that's been a problem since day one for Israel, "but if you do not obey me and you do not observe all of these commandments," you know, God lays it out pretty clearly, doesn't he? He says, "and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you do not perform all my commandments, but you break my covenant, then I will also do this to you." And then God lays out through the next 23 verses the horror and the distress that he says he will bring upon the descendants of Israel for their rebellion against him, the rebellion and unwillingness to follow God. And certainly the curses that are listed out in Leviticus 26, those are amplified. They're discussed in much greater detail through other prophetic books of the Bible. But in Leviticus 26, as I said earlier, if it's been a while since you've gone back and read through that, it would be a good time to read it and refresh yourselves of what God told would happen, or what God said would happen. Because those things that are mentioned there are going to happen leading up to the Great Tribulation and certainly during the Great Tribulation. But let's do turn over to Jeremiah chapter 30. In Jeremiah chapter 30. Jeremiah 30 and beginning in verse 4. And I'm going to read from the NIV, but Jeremiah 30, and beginning in verse 4. "These are the words that the Eternal spoke concerning Israel and Judah. This is what the Eternal says." Now he's going to describe here conditions that happen at the end of the age. He says, "Cries of fear are heard, terror, not peace. Ask and see, can a man bear children? Then why do I see every strong man with his hands on his stomach like a woman in labor, every face turned deathly pale?" Verse 7, "How awful that day will be. None will be like it." And that ties back to Mark chapter 13, Matthew 24, where it says that about the Great Tribulation, that it's a time never seen before, and there will not be a time greater in the future. So this is exactly what the prophet Jeremiah is referring to here. It's during that Great Tribulation. It says, "How awful that day will be, none will be like it. It will be a time of trouble for Jacob, but he will be saved out of it." You know, God always gives us that promise, the other hand in that sense, that olive branch, that yes, we're going to go through punishment, but he will not forsake us permanently. And so the reference here is a very horrific time, and this is a time that points to the period that we refer to as the Great Tribulation. The Great Tribulation is also symbolized by the opening of the fifth seal in Revelation 6. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, because God clearly warned the descendants of Jacob, modern Israel, that the further we moved away from his ways, his laws, the greater the curses would be upon the nation or the nations. And certainly it appears that a lot of the calamity is going to befall on the heads of Manasseh and Ephraim, you know, the two sons that Jacob adopted, Joseph's sons. But in Matthew chapter 24, let's break into the context here. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 12. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end, he shall be saved. In other words, he who stands firm, he who stands faithful, he who is faithful to the end will be saved. Now we tend to view this comment here that Christ makes about lawlessness. I think most often look at it in terms of the condition between, you know, between mankind. That the love between man and the love in our society among people will fade and go away. And that is true, but there certainly is a much greater reference here that Christ is referring to. And that is during this period of time, that this reference also includes a time when people's love for God and God's way of life will grow cold. And we're seeing that now. We are seeing that happen around us every day. And so this is a comment that Christ actually, not only did he talk about the benefit of understanding this for the church, but he also shows that this would be a condition for the descendants of Jacob. That Jacob's view toward God and the teachings of Jesus Christ would fade, would wane. And I think other translations say they wax cold. So over a period of time, that process, they lose the spiritual principles that God gave to the benefit of modern Israel. So all of us know that we should be watching and praying as Jesus Christ instructed us. And while it's important to watch what's happening in the world around us, the most important thing for all of us to be watching is our spiritual condition. That's the most important thing. Because we can know everything, if God revealed it to us, what's going to happen in Europe, what's going to happen in the Middle East, when's this going to occur, how this is going to come together. But if we are not taking care of our own spiritual condition, what does it matter? What benefit will it give? So the most significant area that we should watch is our own personal spiritual condition. Turn back with me to Matthew 26. I want you to look at a passage that, or a statement that Christ made to Peter, actually made it to all of his disciples. And this will give us a little bit of insight in terms of how we're to look at this admonition that Christ gave us to watch and to pray. But in Matthew 26, beginning in verse 40, this is right before Christ was taken by the army and crucified the next day. But beginning in verse 40 of Matthew 26, then he came to the disciples and he found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "What? Could you not watch with me for 1 hour?" Now he's directing this to Peter, but if you go back to the King James Version, what he's going to say here next is actually meant for all of his disciples and certainly for all of God's people. But he says, "What? Couldn't you not watch with me for 1 hour?" Now the same Greek word that we read in Mark 13 about being be aware, be alert, be diligent, or be vigilant, it's exactly the same word here. So Christ is asking Peter and his disciples, how come you couldn't be alert for 1 hour? How come you couldn't be awake for 1 hour? And then he goes on in verse 41, same Greek word, watch and pray, be alert, be attentive, be diligent. And he follows up to say, lest you enter into temptation. You know, it's the same condition that Christ wants all of us to understand as well. Is that we can watch world events, we can know them, we can quote them, we can spend hours reading them. But unless we are worried and watching about our own spiritual condition, the same admonition that Christ gave to his disciples is be on guard, be awake, lest we fall into spiritual decline. That's what that means, falling into temptation, is we allow ourselves to fall into a state of spiritual decline. And then Christ goes on, he says, the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. And so here the admonition is, watch, be alert, pray, be awake. Because if we're not, we're subject to falling into spiritual decline. Christ knew that Satan desired nothing more than to sift his disciples. And Christ knew that in a very short while that he would be taken out of the picture. And Satan would have, in fact, full access to the disciples. And Jesus was imploring them, not just Peter, but all of them. He was imploring them to be vigilant, to stay awake, and to be alert to their spiritual health, to their spiritual condition, and to their spiritual welfare. And that same Satan would love to sift all of God's people. He never tires. So it's the same admonition that Christ gave his disciples, is we are not to fall into a state of spiritual decline. Now let's turn over to Matthew chapter 24. In Matthew chapter 24. And we'll look at a little greater detail here. We've covered this indirectly in the earlier part of the message, but let's pick up here in verse 36 of Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24 and beginning in verse 36. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as in the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Verse 38, For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And they did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. You know, Noah was in the ark for 7 days before the rains came. But once he entered into the ark, it was too late for anyone else. He had prepared himself. He had done what God had commanded him to do. And he entered into the ark with the animals, closed it, shut it, and he waited for God. You know, it's interesting to think, of course, the Bible doesn't tell us, so it's purely speculation. Even going all the way back and looking at the early Bible story books, if you remember those and the pictures that were depicted there by Mr. Wolverton, and you saw the masses there, you know, a lot of creative licensing with that because the Bible doesn't go into that great detail. But you can certainly look at human nature and understand that those were the things that probably occurred. I mean, I can't imagine being in Noah's situation and preaching and teaching for years and never having a convert. And what would it have been like going into the ark, shutting it up, all these animals, it's hot, it's noisy, nothing happens. For 7 days they're in there, nothing happens. I wonder what his sons were saying. Dad, what'd you do to us? There's no rain, there's no flood. And it says they were in the ark for 7 days, and then the waters came. So what Christ is telling us here in this passage, and this is really directed at the greater world in that sense, or maybe the greater world of Israel, but what he's telling us here is that as the days approach, and this will certainly be the days that we often refer to as the Great Tribulation, because when that sixth seal is opened, which is the heavenly signs, and when mountains move, and when islands disappear, and when others are created, and when stars fall to the earth, everybody's going to be aware that something is happening. Whether you're in the church or not, you're going to be aware that something is really happening. Whether it's an alien invasion or who knows what, the world's falling apart, global warming is finally going to occur. Everybody will know. But what Christ is saying here is leading up to the Great Tribulation, it's during that time that Christ or God promises protection to the church, either right before or right at the beginning of the opening of the fifth seal, is when he has promised protection to the church. And then there's the later protection to 144,000, which we won't get into, but they're protected from those bowls of plagues and wrath that occur in the during the day of the Lord. But Christ is talking about a time here leading up to the conclusion of the age. And it's going to seem like life is going on like there's nothing different or unique here. You know, we'll still be getting up and going to work. The alarm clock's still going to go off in the morning. Kids are still going to get up and have to go to class. Referring to mine, I guess, since they're the only ones here. People are going to be planning for a career. Going to be thinking about getting married, having a family, working a job, paying the bills. Imagine that, having to worry about paying bills. Some of us have to worry about dealing with retirement. Is my money going to hold up? You know, it's going to be a normal life, just what we're going through now. I'm still going to be looking at the weather. Is it going to rain? Should I plant? Should I harvest? Life is going to be normal. That's what Christ was saying here. We're going to get colds. We're going to have flus. We're going to stub our toe. We're going to have injuries. We're going to deal with health issues. Life will seem normal. That's what he is saying here. Until it is too late. And then he changes direction in verse 40. And he makes this very personal. He says, then two men will be in the field, and one will be taken and the other left. Now, when we read through this, I've heard this explained a number of different ways. I don't know what the exact intent of this parable or example is. It could be referring to that someone is protected and taken into the place of safety. Or it could simply mean that two people were here, both at one time, diligent, following God's way of life, and one fell into spiritual decay and the other one didn't. But it's a lesson here because Christ makes it personal. But he says, two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Or two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other one left. So maybe in this case, there are examples of people giving up. You know, the Bible does tell us that many are called, but few are chosen. And this could just simply be a follow-on to that. Because the choosing part is us being willing to dedicate our lives to following God and being obedient to Him. And then verse 42, he says, watch. Stay awake. Be alert. Be vigilant. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched, and he would have not allowed his house to be broken into. And we could simply say, if we had known, if we knew the exact hour, we would be ever so diligent to make sure that our relationship with God stayed strong, stayed close, didn't falter. And then he goes on in verse 44, therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. This was directed at Christ's disciples, the church. You know, the world's already clueless. They don't know. They're not looking for a specific return of Jesus Christ. So this is really a warning for all of us that we are to be ready always. Because we don't know exactly when that fifth seal will be opened. Now, let's go to Luke chapter 21. We'll get a little bit more insight into the same theme. Luke chapter 21. Luke 21. And beginning in verse 34. Luke 21, beginning in verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. You know, carousing or dispensation, as other translations use, it just simply means a state of being overindulgent or overindulged. In other words, living in excess, being a glut, being gluttonous in that sense. That's what the Greek means here. And so it's referring here to a direction in our life, or maybe things in our life that come upon us that we put more stock into or more value into. And I think a lot of times we read this and say, well, you know, that's not me. I'm not out carousing. I'm at home. I'm diligent with my job. I'm not out partying night and day. Other translations use that word, partying. Drunkenness, not me. I don't even like alcohol. Why would I be drunk? Cares of this life, well, yeah, it's pretty easy sometimes to get caught up in the cares of this life. But was Christ really talking here about literally being drunk? Well, yes, it's included there. And probably all of us at one time or another have maybe had a little bit too much to drink, hopefully not often. But is the focus on being physically drunk? It can be. But this is a metaphor. And there's many metaphors in the Bible. For example, Christ said, unless you eat of my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in me. We don't physically eat his flesh and drink his blood, but we understand that to be a metaphor for consuming, drinking of his word, understanding his power, his sacrifice. And so here, drunkenness is a metaphor for a state of being or a state of direction. For example, I went back and did a little research on metaphors that use the word drunk or drunkenness. Some of you will laugh because these go back a number of years ago. But this is something we're all familiar with. The world is drowning in debt. Now, is the world really drowning? Is it suffocating? No. The Western economies are drunk on debt. Well, how do you get drunk on debt? It just simply means a state. You want, you know, you're in that state, you want more, which is what has happened. We've caught up in this sort of infatuation that the more we borrow, the better things are going to be. And so you can never get enough. So I think we understand that type of a metaphor. We've all heard this one. He spins like a drunken sailor. What does that mean? That means some sailor's drunk out spending money? Well, that probably occurs. But we use that to express somebody being out of control or not being reasonable, or they're just not balanced. Another metaphor, he's as numb as a drunk. I've heard that. And I can understand that because you read about these head-on collisions with drunk drivers. They're not typically the one who gets killed because they are loose and they're somewhat numb in that sense. Now, this is one that the young folks are probably going to really relate to. I don't ever remember using this, but this was one of the uses of the word drunk. And it could be a guy or a girl. So, that guy, pick on my daughter, is so fantastic, I am drunk with love. Now, we don't hear that, but that was once a metaphor. That was once a metaphor for talking about the emotional overwhelming of love. Now, all of us can think back at a point in time, I don't care how old are you or how old we are, when you were in love with your mate, let's say, and you couldn't feel your feet. You were so on such an emotional high. Right, fellas? I think we can all relate to that. But anyway, this was an expression of somebody being just on an emotional high, being drunk with love. We've all heard this one. Why did you agree to that? What were you thinking? Were you drunk? You know, that's certainly right out of our own vernacular. Another one. You sure drank the Kool-Aid on that one. And then this is from the millennial generation, Accept what life offers you and try to drink from every cup. And so these are all metaphors for drinking, drunkenness. And so when you go back and you look at what Christ was trying to get across to us here, was he specifically talking about a state of physically being inebriated? Well, that's included, but it's much more. You know, drunkenness is a metaphor for being caught up in the excesses of life. And having the excesses of life become more important than the spiritual part of life. That's what he's referring to. So now when you read this, don't say that drunkenness doesn't apply to you. Because I think we've all found ourselves at a point at some time in our life when we're just simply overwhelmed or we're caught up with, I'll make it real simple, living life. And it's easy to get that way. Christ goes on in verse 35. He says, "For it will come," he's talking about the day of the Lord, "it will come as a snare on those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy." And we read that earlier. That you'll be counted, that you'll have the strength, that you'll have the perseverance in that sense to escape all those things or all these things that will come to pass and that you will stand before the Son of Man. Let's turn back to Zephaniah. I just want to look at a quick passage here in Zephaniah, one of the minor prophets. But this book is actually, at least the first part of this book, is directed to the church. The whole book is directed to Israel. But in Zephaniah chapter 2, and beginning in verse 1, I'm going to read from the NIV. Zephaniah 2, beginning in verse 1. It says, gather together, O shameful nation, before the appointed time arrives and that day sweeps on like chaff. Now this is referring to that day of the Lord, that period of time when the end of the age occurs. Before the fierce anger of the eternal comes upon you and before the day of the Lord's wrath comes upon you. So this is the context. Is to look, to be aware. Then in verse 3, Zephaniah was inspired to tell us all. Verse 3, "Seek the eternal, all you humble of the land, you who do what he commands." These are God's people, those who are trying to obey God. And he says here, seek righteousness, seek humility. These are the things that we should be trying to have excesses in, not the cares of this life. But he says, seek righteousness, seek humility. And then notice what he says here, what God inspires him to write, message for all of us. He says, perhaps you will be sheltered on the day of the eternal's anger. You know, we all pray that God will grant his safety to us and that we may be protected during that dreadful time that we refer to as the tribulation. And so we are to seek righteousness, seek humility, put on the character of God, and maybe we will be sheltered or protected on that day. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. I'm going to read from the NIV, beginning in verse 1 of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. "Now, brothers, about times and dates, we do not need to write to you, for you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night." You know, we've been reading about that. Verse 3, "And while people are saying peace and safety," and yes, that's the lingo of our society. It's really the lingo of the whole world, even though things are in terrible shape, people still believe that, yes, peace and safety, long life, good times are not going to go away. "But while people are saying peace and safety, destruction will come upon them suddenly as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape." Verse 4, But you, brothers, are not in darkness, so that this day should surprise you like a thief. Here Paul is saying, you, my brothers, referring to the church, you have been given notice. You have been given warning. You have been given a heads up in that sense. You shouldn't be taken by surprise. He goes on in verse 5, he says, you are all sons of the light and sons of the day, and we do not belong to the night or to the darkness. You know, again, referring to Satan's way of life or the pulls of Satan's character. Verse 6, so then let us not be like others who are asleep, but let us be alert and self-controlled. See, there's that word alert. Let us be watching. Let us be awake. Let us have self-control. In verse 8, but since we belong to the day, let us be self-controlled. Notice what Paul says here, putting on faith and love as a breastplate and the hope of salvation as our helmet. You know, the hope of salvation is our helmet. Have that vision of eternal life. That's what has to be between our ears and under our helmet, is the vision of eternal life and the promises that God has given to us. You know, Christ has instructed us to pray and to watch and to be aware, to be alert, so that spiritually we are prepared for what will come upon the earth, and so that we are strengthened through the promises that God gives us. And he has to pray for that strength so that we will be able to remain diligent and faithful and stand before him at his return. In Revelation 6, you don't need to turn there as I begin to conclude and summarize here. But in Revelation 6, John recorded the first six seals. And he was allowed to see them through a vision. I think we're all familiar with this section of Scripture. And all these seals are opened prior to the day of the Lord, which is pictured through the opening of the seventh seal, and I believe that's in Revelation 8. And the seventh seal is going to be opened, and that pictures a time when the wrath of God will be poured out upon all of mankind because of mankind's sins and because of his rebellion. But the first four seals that are discussed or laid out for us in Revelation 6, they are clearly open now, and they have been open since the days of Jesus Christ. And those four horsemen have been riding through the years, maybe not at great speed or at great intensity at certain times, but certainly they have been riding throughout history, and they have affected and taken a large toll on various areas of populations and at various times. But many prophecies in the Bible indicate and show that as we near the fifth seal, which is pictured as the Great Tribulation, that these four seals will intensify. And we're told that ultimately these four seals are going to affect 25% of the earth's population. Because once a seal is opened, it remains open, and the others just build on top of it. So as we began to move toward the fifth seal or the Great Tribulation, things are going to have a climatic effect upon the earth, or these seals are going to have a climatic impact on the earth. The vision John was seeing to represent the fifth seal was that of the Great Tribulation. And that seal is going to be primarily directed toward the physical descendants of Jacob and God's faithful people. And it's going to occur right before the day of the Lord, and certainly a few years before the return of Jesus Christ. It is this seal that is likely going to be opened very soon. We don't know how long, and that's why we're told to watch. Because it's that seal that releases or begins the Great Tribulation. And it is right before this seal is opened, or maybe right at the very beginning when the seal is opened, that God is going to offer his physical protection to his people, those who remain faithful and loyal to him. Now, the Scripture does tell us that some will be martyred, but God is going to offer physical protection. But we're also told, as we think through the descriptions of prophecy and what lies ahead for all of us, maybe not us being in the context of the church, but certainly us being the descendants of Israel, primarily the descendants of Jacob. And sometimes we don't like to think about it or read it. We don't like to look at what is going to come upon mankind. But when we put all the prophecies together, we know that the world, that the earth is going to be ravaged in that sense, and that millions, actually billions of lives are going to be lost. But God looks at it as a part of His plan. It's a way of bringing the world to repentance, and it's a way of actually introducing the good news. All the stuff that we look forward to, a time when there's going to be great joy. And so, as we've covered in this sermon, a lot of more difficult areas to think about and look at, I thought I would end on a more pleasant note. If we turn over to Revelation 22, this is always at the end of the story. And let's look at what God is telling us here. In Revelation 22, this is right after the New Jerusalem comes upon the earth. Beginning in verse 1, Revelation 22. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the middle of its street, and on either side of the river, was a tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So here we're seeing a very prosperous time when the tree of life is going to be available to all of mankind. And then notice here what Christ inspired John to write in verse 3. And he says, and there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall be with him. What is the curse that God is going to take away? And certainly the curses of disobedience. I referred to those back in Leviticus 26. But is this the curse that God is talking about here? Is it just the calamity for disobedience that's ended? Or is it something else? Hold your place here. We're going to come back to it. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3. And I'm going to read from the NIV. But in Genesis chapter 3, going back and beginning with verse 17, we know the story here that Adam and Eve sinned. They fell to the sway of Satan, and they did eat of that prohibited fruit. And here God is talking to them and giving them correction. The earlier part of this chapter, he directs his comments toward that dragon, Satan the devil. But in verse 17 of Genesis 3, he says to Adam, because you listened to your wife and you ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Then notice what he says here to Adam. He says, cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since that is where you were taken from. For dust you are, and dust you will return. So here we see a curse. Is this the curse that God is going to take away? Well, it's going to happen, yes. That's a good part of it. We certainly know that most of us do not live in an agrarian society. But those of us who farm relate to this very clearly. There's thistles and thorns, and it is a difficult life. But what God was telling Adam here is, your life as a physical human being is going to be tough. You know, for most of the world, it's been a very tough life. Except for those few who take power or who take wealth, life has been a challenge for every human being. And so God made this prophecy, or He fulfilled this prophecy, because life as a human being, up until this point in time, has been extremely difficult. We all understand how we labor to make ends meet. But is this the real curse that God is going to remove? Let's drop down to verse 24 of Genesis chapter 3. Verse 24 of Genesis 3. And after he drove the man out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life. This is the curse that God is going to take away. This is the curse that's referred to in Revelation 22. That when Adam and Eve sinned, God separated himself from man and did not dwell in man's presence. He removed himself, or he removed Adam and Eve from his presence. And that curse, man being separated and apart from God, that is going to be taken away. Revelation 22, chapter 4, or chapter 22, verse 4. Going back to Revelation, verse 4 of Revelation 22. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. There shall be no light there. They need no lamp, nor light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. Perfect eternal harmony, living in the family of God. It would be a terrible and dreadful thing if we ever allow the cares of this life to ensnare us and cause us to miss out on a fantastic future that God has promised us. And I hope we'll all remain sensitive to that. That we'll never give up, we'll never quit, and we'll never allow anything to take us away from the wonderful promises that God gave to us. Let's watch, as Christ admonished us to do. Let's pay attention to what is happening on around the world, but in specific, particular emphasis, let's especially watch with regards to our spiritual condition. Let's watch and pray that we are given the strength to prevail and stand before Christ at his return.